Welcome to episode 100. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host, Unholly.
Aha, yes! Welcome to episode 100 of How Did I Get Here? I am your host, Johnny Gowdy. This is the 100th time I'm saying hello to you. This is very exciting for me. I'm excited doing this podcast. I love doing it. I've been having a great time. I feel like I've grown as a person from it, from reaching out to my peers and talking to people and kind of figuring out, you know, it's made me inspired to stay in the game, to do this, keep on talking to people, keep on making music, and just to keep on keeping on. I've been getting a ton of great feedback, you know. I went out on Monday night, a week ago. And I went and saw some friends of mine play, and all of them came up and told me some of the favorite things they've heard on it, and it was making me very happy. Then I went to another show afterwards, and I went to go park, and I was putting some money in this thing, and this guy came up to me, and he wrote me on Twitter later, but he came up to me, and he said he had just moved here and felt like he was really learning about Austin and the music scene through my podcast. So that's good. It's been exciting. It's been very exciting. And then I went to this show. I went to go see the Rocket Boys, who've been on the show. And they were doing a show with Bob Schneider, who was doing a weird kind of show. And guys, you know, so guys at the bar were coming up and saying hey. And then a couple of people. I saw Lang Freeman from the second episode of the podcast. And he was telling me about how he liked the David Grissom episode. And then I saw Bob Schneider at the end of the night, and he came walking up and told me he was loving the podcast as well. And so I asked him if he'd be on it. He said, yeah. So next week I'm going to go meet with Bob, and he's going to be starting off the second 100 episodes. I'm really excited about this. I'm very happy. I'm stoked. And I support, a lot of people have been supportive. I remember, when I started this podcast, I've lived with a girl. Her name was Jessie. Her name still is Jessie. We were boyfriend and girlfriend, and she lived here, and she was very encouraging. You know, it took me a long time to get my head around, sitting down to actually do this. It took me months. Like, I spent 6 months actively thinking about it almost on a daily basis, you know, that music. I still don't turn down my phone when I'm in the when I'm recording stuff. So, you know, Jessie helped out a lot, and she really encouraged me and really gave me a lot of support, and would always clean up the place before the guests would come over, make it nice, you know, so that they were happy when they came here. And I guess since then, Jessie and I broke up. So that's happened throughout the podcast. And I took a week off from the podcast because I was literally too sad to podcast. I felt like when I interviewed people, I would just tell them how sad I was, and I did actually, I think, the first couple ones afterwards. So anyway, I'd like to thank my cousin Eric, who was very supportive and talked me into doing it at the beginning and really pushed me to do it. And also Kathy Valentine, who's been a very good music friend and just an all-around good friend. I went to lunch with her, and I was like, hey, I'm thinking about starting this podcast where I interview musicians. And she was like, do it. Do it because you're the guy to do it. And it's not because I think it's because, A, I like to talk, but B, I'm curious about how people do things and how they get through things. And really, I can't tell you how much talking to my friends about that stuff and talking to people I don't really know has really helped me. And really made me a much happier person. Because before I started this podcast, I was kind of lost. I didn't really know exactly what my next move was going to be, and so this kind of like opened it up. It gave me a new purpose, gave me something to work on, you know. And that's something to be said for that. So anyway, all the great support from the people in the beginning. Thank you so much for being so great, Todd, Jessie, Kathy, cousin Eric. And so anyway, I guess let's start playing some highlights. That's what we're going to do today. Highlights, episode 100. So, let's go back to episode one. But before I talk about episode one, There was an episode before episode one. My friend Jeremy Nail came over one day, and I asked him if he would sit down and let me try out this interview thing I was doing, or I was going to try and do. And we did it, and I was terrible. When I went back and listened to it, I was really disappointed in myself. So we'll get Jeremy back on here again. Jeremy and I were in a band together, Liars and Saints. And when he came over, I was just kind of like, hey, will you do this, you know, while you're here? And so he's like, yeah. And I did a terrible job. So I went back to the drawing board for like a week or two. And then I called upon another good friend, someone that I have a great rapport with. We make each other laugh all the time. And she's an interesting person, Susanna Schaffel. And so anyway, this is actually really interesting because I guess we did this back in August of 2011. And then in October of 2011, she moved to New York. And then when she's living in New York, I guess over the summer, I've been seeing these pictures of her like in New York and then pictures in LA. I follow her on Instagram. And literally, it's like I'm like an Instagram private investigator if you need me to find anything out. So I'm like, what in the devil is going on? She's like, it seemed like she was in L.A. one week and in New York the next week, in L.A. the next week, in New York the next week. And I didn't ask, but then somebody told me that she was on The Voice. And it turns out she's on The Voice, which starts like next week. And so look for this girl, Susanna Schaffel, on The Voice. In this part of the conversation, we were talking about the movie Catfish, and she had a video and her performing a Johnny Cash song in this movie Catfish, and it was kind of a pivotal part of the story in the movie, and I was totally surprised. I didn't know it was in it anyway. So here's from episode one. Here's my conversation with Susanna Schaffel, and she's telling me about Catfish.
No, that wasn't. Catfish was a weird, like, they used
what happened?
It was a Johnny Cash song, Tennessee Stud.
Oh, right.
I played
okay.
It at moments.
You're right.
And it was just some random.
And it was actually a YouTube video, or did they ask you to use it, or what happened?
Yeah, it was a YouTube video that this woman had extracted the audio from because this guy asked her. I don't know if you've seen the movie.
But yeah, I saw it. That's how I saw the thing.
Yeah, I'm telling the listeners.
Oh, sorry.
No, whoa. It's. Did you get surprised that I said listeners? No, like,
there's people
Johnny,
listening?
Johnny, I'm telling the audience. So you can't see them, but they're here.
Okay. I like this.
I don't know if you've seen the movie, but no. Okay. Yeah. No, anyway.
Please tell them,
so the woman.
It's a bigger independent movie.
Yeah, it
and
is.
And it's available
it's
on Netflix.
Exciting.
It's an instant download.
Yeah.
And people, I get a text message every once in a while from a friend that's like, hey, aren't you friends with Susanna Schaffel? She's in this movie,
cool.
Catfish. My cousin Eric did that one night.
Oh, right on. Yeah. I get texts too to this day. They're like, did you know you're in? I love that everyone goes, did you know you're in this movie, Catfish? And I'm like,
what almost seems like. It could have been done without your knowledge.
Well, and what's funny is it kind of was. My management knew about it, but it was kind of put on the back burner. So apparently this is what happened. The movie was being made whenever this was 2 years ago or something. And they contacted my manager at the time who, and they were like, hey, this happened. They explained what happened. They're like, we want to use this clip, but we have to have your permission. And so he said, okay, yes, you have my permission. And then my management switched. But the new guy was told about it. I guess the music supervisor of the movie, this is then a few months later, the music supervisor called him and was like, hey, we need your permission and we need to work out a deal and blah, blah, blah. So I was compensated. I got like the licensing fee or whatever. It was just flat little rate. So basically, yeah, it's so weird. What actually happened was in the movie, this guy and this girl who have this internet relationship through Facebook, the guy asks her to sing Tennessee Stud because he knows that she works with horses and she's also let on that she's a singer. And so she went onto YouTube, I suppose, this woman, and just Googled Tennessee Stud. And mine was maybe like one of the first that popped up, like a female anyway, singing it.
Right.
Obviously, there's Johnny Cash. But
right.
So anyway, she extracted the audio and sent it to him. And it's so weird because I remember seeing the movie and it's like my voice comes out of the computer in the movie and it's just like, and he
did you see it in the theater?
Yeah, I saw it in the theater. They actually like, they gave me like front row seats or whatever, and like it was kind of like a
did they have
premiere
a premiere
thing.
Here in Austin?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's awesome. And you met the director and everything. And
I didn't get to meet them. I, you know, what's funny is it played at South by. Here's what I was gonna say: is it played at South by? I suddenly get all these texts and these emails saying, "Do you know you're in this movie?" And that was my first. I was like, "What is this?" So I emailed my manager, and he was like, "Holy crap! I got to get in touch with these people. I didn't know they did not let me know that they have already released it. They're already premiering it."
Okay.
So it was kind of like one of those things where he had to suddenly put things in high gear because they kind of dropped the ball on contacting us. So anyway, then I knew about it.
That's going to sound great.
I know.
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Look out, sound people.
Effect. Look out. Watch out.
I'm going to tell people you did it in the shape of a Z.
Yeah. For Xana. So then it came back after South by like a couple months later, and they were like, "We'd love to have you." This is kind of the official, you know, that was the premiere for South by, but this is when they were really releasing it,
right.
You know? And so they're like, "We'd love to have you there." I missed the directors by like a day, but they emailed me and all were really cool. And so anyway, it was just this random little weird appearance thing that was great. It was great press for me for...
This is how what we do that? It in an apartment. I guess I need to get better. It's just like a guy rolling a cart.
Oh, it sounded like a train coming in the headphones. It was kind of exciting.
It is like a train coming in the headphones.
So anyway, yeah, Catfish, blah, blah, blah. It was cool. It was a fun little, like, yay, I'm on the big screen.
And I mean, did that open doors, do you think? Do you think that kind of helped you out?
It did.
Kind of boosted some awareness of
Susanna. It definitely boosted awareness. Like, if you look at, you know, you can monitor your, like, downloads online. Yeah. And it was like that. You know, 2 months or whatever that it was, you know, my sales peaked. So that was cool. And it's just fun. I actually thought it was a really cool movie.
It was a great movie.
Yeah. And so I was happy to be a part of that and to be intertwined somehow into that. So that was cool.
Movie Catfish. Catfish was a good movie. I liked it a lot. Yeah. Susanna, can you believe it, man? She was on the big screen. Now she's going to be on the TV screen starting April 10th on The Voice. You know, man, I'm going to watch that shit, man. I love her, and I'm going to cheer her on. Do you call and vote on that show? Is that like that kind of show? I can't remember. I'm going to turn my chair around every time she's on. That's right, because I'd want her on my team if I was one of those people. Susanna Schaffel. God damn it, I love her. Thank you for being episode one. Anyway, so after that, I did a couple more episodes. The next one that I did of note... not that anyone is smaller or better, but I literally can't do like 99 highlights on here. I can only do a few. So the next one was episode 4. It was Donnie Wynn, who's a drummer, played with Robert Palmer, Brooks and Dunn, tons and tons of people in between. And he and I played together. And he was people all, when I told them I was starting this podcast, everyone said, get Donnie. And this is actually the favorite. This is the one I've heard the most about from people. This is the one that really, really got people excited about the podcast. So I want to thank Donnie for doing this. After this, he played with Robert Plant in the last year and with tons of other people. We did a real cool show together with A&R Peterson from the Kelly Clarkson Band and AJ Vallejo, who was also a guest on here. The four of us played a couple months ago with Todd Wolfson. It's fantastic, right? So anyway... this is Donnie Wynn talking about recording the song Clues with Robert Palmer.
That brings back a couple of memories.
Does it?
Yeah, okay, man, that was a real special time. It was... probably the most important record I ever made was that one, of which that came from Clues, the album Clues, the album.
The album Clues, the song Looking for Clues.
I've already dated myself, right?
You have.
I called it an album.
Yeah, it was
an
LP.
That's what it was in those days, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a strange one. That was only the second record I had done with the gentleman in question, Robert Palmer, and we were... on tour, promoting the record before that, Secrets. We had Bad Case of Loving You, all that stuff. Can We Still Be Friends, some other ones. But we were on tour, and I'll never forget, we were in Salem, Massachusetts. And there was this wonderful woman from Buffalo, New York, who was with me at the time. And
it's like in the movie Almost Famous. Like you picked her up in another city, and she came with you?
We called it importing. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. You imported, you know? because we always allowed girlfriends and paramours and whatnot to join in, you know. And it was always an understood thing. So, yeah, there was this wonderful young lady. We were enjoying each other's company, and this insistent knock at the door. I tried to ignore it, and finally she started, you know, saying, go away, you know. And then the voice coming back started saying, hey, I got to play you something. And I recognize whose voice it is. And understand, my room used to be the gathering room when we were on the road. I had this thing that Keith Richards had. It was this Nakamichi Little David system that fit into a Halliburton suitcase.
Okay.
You can have the thing set up in 30 seconds, and you're blowing the walls out of the place. I mean, it was awesome.
That's awesome.
So my room was the guy. I had one. I went and bought one. Keith told me about it. Told me this one place in New York City that made it. I went and got it. These old Jewish guys, I got it. $1,000. It was a good deal.
Yeah.
And Robert was banging. Finally, I'm like, what? You know, I got this chick in here. And he goes, man, I heard a song. We got to listen to it. It's important, I think. I was like, but he goes, it's important. And I'm like, I got to listen to motherfucker here. He seems to kind of have his finger on the bead. So I think I'll let him in. I was like, Patty, you know, Robert's coming in for a second. He played me Gary Numan's Cars.
Right.
Over and over. And I mean, we started listening to it at about 1 o'clock. It was a good 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning.
Still listening
before
to
finally,
it.
Yeah. I mean, over, just repeat, over and over. There was something that just really got him about the time structure, the way time was really on it.
Yeah.
Because before that, things, you know, there it weren't leads. Click tracks. Yeah. There weren't drum machines. Right. Well, there were click tracks, but
they were good, primitive drum
the
machines.
The good people didn't
use them on
them.
Records.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So he says, there's something about this groove that, you know, with it insistent like that, I can fit. He was a real, he understood groove unlike anyone I've ever seen. But he goes, I can wrap my voice around that in a lot of different ways for the phrasing of any particular song we
phrasing.
Do.
He was like a real, like almost in a crooner kind of rock singer. You know?
He studied some of the best and picked up some of the best, you know, and then took it to his own place. So we finished that tour. He's off in Japan doing some promo to get ready for the next record. He finds these little machines, the Wasp and the Spider. They're little toys. Black and yellow keys, but they're not really keys. It's just plastic. It just looks like keys. And only about, you know, that many.
Right.
And on each, that's
eight keys. There you go. Good.
and he brought these things down to Nassau. He lived in the Bahamas.
Right.
He was a tax exile. Chris Blackwell had his...
Now, did you live there then? Or?
Not then. I was living in Los Angeles then.
Okay.
But Chris had this whole back end of the island set up with villas and places to live and beaches, and it was all our playground.
Was it Compass Point?
Compass Point Studio.
I've been there. I just went and looked at it. I never went and played.
But when I was a teenager, I was there. Love beaches right across the way, and I mean, amazing place.
Yeah. It's literally like Bjork. I heard a story aside that Bjork recorded her vocal tracks. They stretched the... you know, mic cord across, and she did him on the beach.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
So he was living there.
And he played me these things. He was listening to these bass sequences, and he wrote funny, and he had a home studio back then, and I always would listen to his recordings. He called them his demos, and I would go, what are we here for?
Right.
I mean, boom, that pretty much makes a statement. He goes, no, y'all bring a vitality and an energy to it that I really like.
Yeah.
Whatever that is. So he brought me down for the next record. I remember I had this old 1956 11x14 Slingerland marching snare. I don't know why I brought it, but when I recently refurbished it, I found it in storage. It was a mess. And Alex Sadkin was the engineer. Alex went on to do some amazing things with Duran Duran and Foreigner and all kind of people. He killed in a Jeep crash. His Jeep overturned and killed him and there in the Bahamas. Right as his career was
taken off.
He was the engineer, kind of quasi co-producer on the thing. But I go in there with this drum, and Robert had this old Gretsch kit, so I set up the bass drum. I like to do things very simply. You know, you've worked with me. I don't like to put up a huge kit. If I can just do it on a hi-hat, snare, and bass drum, boom, we're good. So I sat those elements up, and all of a sudden, based on that Clues thing you were just playing, the sequence is da 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 da. And of course, modulating and doing the things that it does, but that's it. That's all I'm hearing.
Right.
I'm like, well, what do you want me to do to it? He goes, play with it. I was like, but, you know, my whole thing with drums is it's a conversation between the vocalist and me.
Yeah.
And not knowing what the song's about. Right. I mean, how do I even begin to play? He goes, it's a musical thing. Just play with it. Have fun. I'm like, well, there's that weird gap in there. He goes, well, do something. Okay. Bap, 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 you know.
Yeah.
So I did the drum track, playing with the damn sequence. They had some great pot down there, so your imagination, it was you're not a problem to go somewhere else. You're in the Bahamas, for God's sakes. You know, if you can't find imagination down there, you're in trouble. But I did. I laid drum tracks to all this shit. Gary Newman flew down. He actually flew down. He was in that Escape when he became hugely famous.
Right.
And he was a pilot. He had this little black plane, and he was flying around the world just to get the fuck away from the press. So he heard we were doing one of his tunes, I Dream of Wires. He flies down. And just wants to hang out for a couple of days. And did. And, of course, that was unusual, coinciding with the impetus of this whole thing. Right. I get through with my drum bits. I leave. 8 months later, David Harper, his manager, who also lived in Los Angeles, said, come over to the house. I got something to play for you. And he played me that record. And imagine me having only heard...
Yeah.
I call it the blips and beeps record, because that's all I fucking heard.
Yeah.
Imagine going from just that... to what he ended up with. I mean, he was sequencing shit. He was, there's some Frank Sinatra strings that are backwards on there. Uh-huh. He was sampling things. I mean, this is 1980.
Yeah.
People weren't doing that shit back then. And what was interesting, to get to the point of this whole thing, I know it's long-winded.
No, this is what you're here for. That's why we have a podcast. There's no commercial break. There's no time limit.
Yay. So the thing that helped me, the reason I say it was the most important record for me is it taught me one time, and not just time and play with this click track. It's about, in this particular section, move the drum up a little bit, put the bass drum way back here. Yeah. Now when it switched to the next section, change those elements around. I mean, you can boss the thing around.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, though, at the time. I was just kind of going along with the game, but... all of a sudden, he comes up with a song called Woke Up Laughing, which is on the same album.
Right.
It's an imbutural. It's three time signatures at once. And they all meet up at the one, but their ones are just different. But eventually, they all meet up.
Right.
They all share a one. Say, right. You know, but one's in four, the other one's in 12, and another one's somewhere else.
Right.
And he wanted me to play elements of both beats at the same time.
Okay.
Because he kept changing with his lyric, he said. But, of course, I don't hear the fucking lyric, so...
Because you're just playing to the
thing. I'm just playing... Dun, 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 dun. That's all I got.
Right.
He's wanting me to play a funky beat, but he says, keep changing to the different time signatures and then incorporate all of them into one. And I told him, I said, you're absolutely insane. I told him this. He should have fired me on the spot, but luckily for me, he liked me, and he didn't. But... he said, no, it mathematically, this works. And I said, I can play it for you all day. And I would sit and play it for him, looking right at him, playing it, making it swing, making it feel good.
Yeah.
Then he'd put that fucking thing, that sequence on, and I couldn't play with it for shit. And I was like, no, it's just impossible to do it. The Africans didn't have that shit, and that's what you're asking me to do. And it just doesn't work with machines. You're crazy. He goes, well, mathematically, it works. So understand that, and you'll be fine. For a week... I called him insane, crazy.
Right.
This ain't going to work. His manager even believed me.
Right.
Started siding with me.
Right.
He insisted and was extremely patient. Like I said, he didn't fire me. And then one day, I'll never forget, I went for a walk on the beach, and then we were in the little car going down to Compass Point to start that day, and boom, that proverbial light bulb.
Yeah.
I found it. Like, oh, if I do that... So I had to go in and go, you know, I'm looking real meek right now. I walked in and was like, I'm real sorry. You're not crazy, and I know how to do it. And sat down and boom, did it right off the bat. But it taught me everything about time and how to maneuver it. So it was very important to me.
You're going to want to listen to that one, the whole thing. It's long, but it's really good. If you haven't heard it, it is a fan favorite, like... people that listen to this show, that is their favorite one, and it's well worth it, I promise. So next, I had a few more, and then my very dear friend Ian Moore came in, We had an interesting conversation that lasted a really long time. We talked about his whole career and everything. I suggest listening to that one too. But on this one, start exploring a little bit. Let's start looking at some different stuff, maybe the emotional side. And in this one, he talks about how playing with a guy, Chris Searles, who's a big fan of the show. I haven't had him on yet, but he was just on Leno the other night on Friday. Can you believe that? Amazing. Plays with Alejandro Escovedo, who was on the show. And Billy White, who was on the show as well. My God, it's everywhere. Anyway, so he was talking about how Ian was talking about how Chris Searles came on board on a tour and how much he loved playing with him and how something he said to him changed his life during a difficult time in his career. So this is for you, Chris Searles. Here's a little bit of Ian Moore.
I'm looking out on the new terrain.
JJ and George played with you for a while.
Yeah, for quite a while, and then Chris Searles replaced JJ. But that was really cool because me and Chris and David and everybody had been friends,
right.
And so having Chris play was really neat. And we did that. And as a matter of fact, I just saw Chris Searles yesterday, and we were talking about this. I remember I loved playing with Chris and hanging out with Chris because Chris is such an amazing human being outside of it being a drummer and. And he really helped me to understand, like his father's a reverend, and he would tell me, he goes, I've been trying to understand where you're coming from. And it's like, I almost feel like you're like a religious leader in the way that you view music and you want, and I never thought of, and I'm not saying that I was powerful,
but
that's how I thought about it. And I want this, because I do, I want this spiritual synergy, a communion.
Yeah.
And he goes, and he would get so frustrated because that band, when Searles came in, was badass, like really badass. Like we had he was playing, Bucca was playing, so Bucca was playing great. So we had a lot of the elements of the early band, and then Searles and George are just amazing. And everybody was really showing up. And I think Searles just was beaten down by the fact that there was this inequity between the energy that he felt like we were doing and the energy that the people were giving back. And it literally, I remember him telling me, like on this one tour in particular, he just could not do it. He loved playing the music. He could not deal with the reaction from the crowd because it was bumming him out too much.
Wow.
And I just remember feeling, you know, there are times when you ebb and there are times when you flow. And you can try to fight and go, you know, give this to me now, or you can just let go of it. And as painful as it is, especially for people around, sometimes you just have to let go. And it's just not your time, and you're not going to win.
Yeah.
So, you know.
That's a hard realization to come, or at least admit to yourself and then act on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, having things fall apart is fine.
Right.
As long as you're okay with it.
Right.
Because that means that something new is going to come up. And so, you know, Chris really was so valuable. I probably should tell him that. I don't think I've ever told him that succinctly, but he was really valuable in that transition for me. Because he kind of prepared me basically for the fact that it didn't matter how hard I tried. It wasn't something that was going to be a sweat equity thing. It was going to pay off. And if I, you know, sometimes you keep your intention clear and people feel it. Other times it's like, you know, time to move on.
Right. Another great podcast. I love both of those guys. I was fortunate enough to, I toured opening for Ian throughout my career. And then I toured in his band in 2007. And really, like, the best touring experience I've ever had, the best time I've ever had on the road, really. And I have a great, great amount of affection for Chris Searles, who hopefully will be a guest on this show soon, and that'll be awesome, right?
Right.
I want to thank a couple of other people who've jumped on and been very supportive, very nice. My friend Nicole Naufel from she manages a couple bands, Debbie Darling and Black Taxi. She listens to a lot of episodes. Always gives me good feedback. My good pal, Robert George in Ireland, who listens to this. He listens to a lot of episodes. Hi, Robert. You're awesome. Pablo, who I met one time walking down the street, and he came up and has been helping me along. Just a fan of the show. Hooked me up with Earl Poolball. He'll be a guest in September at some time. Pretty exciting. This has been a pretty exciting thing, making friends along the way. A lot of people. The guy at the pay thing on Monday night. Never saw him before. I congratulate him for liking me. So there was more, and then along the line, I met up with Miles Zuniga from Fastball, and he came up and he told me he was digging the podcast. He'd been listening to it, and asked him to be on, and he was in the process of putting out a new record. And that was very cool. We talked about some Fastball stuff, and this is what I'm doing on this highlight, because I also interviewed Tony Scalzo from Fastball, but at a different time. So what you're about to hear is the story of them getting to make their second record, which had this song, The Way. And first you'll hear Miles tell the story, and then you'll hear Tony tell the stories. Two sides of one story. You see what I'm doing here? Was there like a, was the record label still behind you, like very behind the whole thing? Like, oh,
no,
was there this doubting when you went to go do your second record?
There was a magical, you know, magical, how to describe it? It's just like fate.
Yeah.
Is the only way I can describe it. All the levers moved just the right way so that we could have a success. I don't know how to describe it. It just, for the first time and the last time, possibly, I've never had this crazy, quirky series of events line up so perfectly. What happened was the head of the label got fired. He didn't like the band anyways, but the president of the label, he got fired. So he wasn't there to say, get rid of these guys. Yeah. We should have, anybody would have dropped us. Yeah. We sold like 1,000 copies.
Yeah.
They didn't promote the record. No one cared. No one liked our band. Not really, you know?
Yeah.
And he got fired, but our A&R guy still had his job. A&R guy goes to the accountant, who is now head of the label, and says, can we make another Fastball record? He goes, I don't care. I won't be here, and I won't even be here next year, you know. They're going to fire me. Here, I'm signing off. A budget approved. We go to the studio, do the hit record with no one from the record company.
Watching.
Yeah. No one coming down to listen. No one bugging us.
It's fucking validating, though, right?
It was amazing. Nobody was there to like go. We had the producer who worked at the label, Julian Raymond, who worked at the label, and our A&R guy. But those guys were good friends, and it really felt like a family. There was no. We didn't have to have the record like play it for the president or play it for the head of market. Nothing. Nobody knew if they'd have a job when the new regime rolled in. So, yeah, we just did this record in the summer of 97. Very innocently, and smoothest recording project I've ever been associated with. Everything went like that.
Yeah.
Clockwork. Loved the engineers. Loved the producer. It was a joy. It was like, I was like, this is the way it should be. And it just happened. Everything, within a month, the record was in the can, mixed, everything, done.
Wow.
But there was no president. There was no one to say, we're going to release it. We didn't know if it would ever come out. We're just sitting there now in limbo. This is August of 97.
Yeah.
And we wait all the way through till the new year.
Right.
That's what happened. So for months, you know, the euphoria quickly died down.
Right.
I moved to California. I didn't know what was going to happen with the band. I thought we might not ever get the record out, and if it doesn't come out, I'm going to do something else. I mean, I can't, you know, I was 30 years old at that point, and I didn't know where my life was going.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seemed,
yeah,
we weren't supporting ourselves with the band. I mean, it wasn't like we were a big live draw or anything.
Right, yeah.
So I went to California, started working as an extra in these movies and stuff, and I came home from one particularly crappy extra job. And there was a message on the phone from our A&R guy that the radio guy had flown around and taken our record to all these different stations. And there was one station in St. Louis or somewhere that was playing it. And I was so excited. They were playing The Way on the radio. And I just thought, I'm not going to work anymore. I just decided then and there. And I haven't since. I just thought, I'm not going to take any
This is it. This is going to happen now. I just could feel it. I just believed it. And then, you know, every week something more fantastic would happen. Yeah. They'd go, are you sitting down?
All these people started moving to Hollywood Records. Hollywood was, by the way, without a head. There was no president. They had fired their president.
Okay. The giant snake, like Disney snake.
Yeah, so they didn't really... That's probably why we hadn't gotten dropped, because right. there was no one to drop us.
Right.
No one to make that decision.
Yeah, no one noticed.
But we're in there, and next thing you know, Bob Cavallo, Big Bob... There's two Cavallos. There's Rob Cavallo
Rob
and Bob.
Yeah.
Bob's the dad. Bob is the big manager of Christina Aguilera, Goo Goo Dolls. I mean, it's huge.
Right,
Prince.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's sick. And but Bob became the president, and everybody was saying, well, he does, you know, he came here to your label because of this song. And we had some other people, like Mark DiDio came from Capitol, I think. And all these people started converging on, you know, Buena Vista Avenue, going to Disney lot, and that's where Hollywood Records is.
Right.
And they started pushing it before we even finished the record. I mean, the packaging wasn't even together yet. And college stations.
They started kind of taking
Different markets across the country started playing, and they started getting all these calls like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Who is this? What is this?
Yeah.
So it came out, and by the time the record wasn't even out, I think the radio was on like a number 15 on the alternative charts nationwide.
Yeah.
So K Rock, where all of a sudden we're in K Rock, my old station from back in
At that point, K Rock was a taste making
radio station.
You got added
still,
to K Rock.
In fact,
the
I would
States.
Say Fastball is probably with a few other bands. We're the last. That's it, man. We're the last of the 20th century bands where they really threw money at you and said, you know,
yeah,
you know, you've done it now. Boom. You know, that sort of started with, you know, that big buzz with Nirvana and, you know, all
right.
of a sudden indie bands getting signed to majors and selling millions of records.
Right.
We hadn't sold, you know, millions of records yet.
Yeah.
But it looked like we were going to, and we started, you know, it just took off.
So just on a personal level, I mean, just
And they knew it. That's the freaky part, is that they knew.
They knew it was coming.
And Bob Cavallo, I was in the bathroom with Bob Cavallo, and we're like, you know, next to each other.
Right.
And he goes, boy, it's number 15 now. I think that next week it's going to be number 11, and then maybe get down to, but I mean, it actually made it to the number one slot on the alternative charts. It's like he knew, like clockwork, how it was going to go. And it went that way. And he said he wasn't sure about number one, but, you know,
right.
And once it got there.
Like someone touched you on the head with their magic wand.
But you know what? I can pinpoint the moment that I knew that the arc had been crested. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's like, you're number one. Well, there's nowhere to go.
That's it.
But back up.
Right. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I'll be damned if it didn't happen that way. And it was, you know, I think the out of my head.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Fire Escape charted
yeah.
at something like 39 or something. So it was a top 40 hit. And then out of my head made it to something like 15.
Okay.
Maybe 20. So top 20 hit. And that really helped everything for the next 2 years. But then we had to make another record.
Right. They're still playing, you know, Fastball, still out there, making records. They actually have a song called How Did I Get Here? Yeah, I should play it at the end of it, at the end of the show today. I think I will. I will. So anyway, as the shows went on, you know what, real quick, thanks to all the guests that have been on. I hope that you guys have all had a great time. You all have acted like you have. Almost everyone has. Anyway, as the shows went on, I started pulling in some non-musicians, and one guy that was a big supporter of the show was my good friend Dale Dudley. He has the Dudley and Bob Morning Show here in Austin, very popular on KLBJ. And on this segment, we talk about why comedians hate doing morning shows.
Yeah,
So let me ask you this. What's the problem with comedians and morning shows? I'll tell you my problem with normal morning, or not even morning. It's just regular radio people. When you go on, and I've heard Patton Oswalt kind of go off on shit like this. But my personal problem that I relate to in that situation is there's a dismissive vibe a lot of times when you go in. Like, they'll be like, oh, yeah, and they're doing another job. And a lot of times comics, and I notice this even a little bit more than musicians, are so personal about if you're paying attention to them, because obviously they're talking. You know what I mean? And so is that what – do they come in with that attitude without knowing
what
you do?
Let's do that, and then when we do this, you've got to ask me about what radio's problem is when musicians come in.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Go ahead. I've talked to you about before.
Okay.
And it's not all radio. I get Patton Oswalt's I was following Patton on Twitter, and I love Patton Oswalt. He's been one of our best guests ever. And I hope we do this differently. And we've heard from every comic. I mean, I'm doing Doug Benson's podcast at the end of November.
And you've had him on
yours.
And
he's done mine. Yeah. There are a lot of comics that will say our radio show is different. And again, if you're in the middle of the podcast, it's 93.7 FM in Austin, and you can tune in at klbjfm.com in the morning. We do stream live. We try. Now, not always is it successful, and here's the difference. And this isn't a matter of tooting our own horn. I'm just telling you from my perspective. I tried to do stand-up comedy in the early 80s.
I was going
to
ask
I wasn't bad for looking back at that kid. I was a prop comic, which comics hate, but I didn't know it at the time. I never got far enough into it
What kind of props?
Oh, ridiculous stuff. I had a whole
hand puppets or anything like
that? Yeah, everything. I had a hand puppet, but I did a whole bit. It was really bad. I did a bit from Alien where the thing pops out of his chest, but instead of a Fozzie Bear popped out of the guy's chest.
Okay.
I wish I did on tape because it's really, really bad. But I did hang out with comedians, and I got to know Bill Hicks a little bit.
Okay.
And Bill and I were, I would say, acquaintances. I don't want to say friends.
Were you down in Houston during that time? Or
no, or I was in Lubbock.
Okay. He was coming up there.
But everybody was, dude, Lubbock had 3 comedy clubs at one time. That's how huge comedy was in 82.
It exploded.
It was insane.
Yeah.
And I was the house comic for one called The Laughing Stock of Texas. And then there was the Abbey Road. And then there was another one. I can't remember the name of it. But Bill came through. And he would stay up all night partying and then come in and do my radio show. And then I would give anything for tapes. I've got thousands of tapes of stuff that no one will ever listen to. And I've yet to run across one that had Bill on. And Bill would come in and literally just do Elvis for 30 minutes on the air. But I hung around those guys. So when the radio show started taking off and we started getting comics in there, I never wanted the comic to come in and tell jokes. I wanted him to come in and do what Bill did in Lubbock, which is hang out and refuse to do bits, right? Not go into your stage routine, because I wouldn't do my stage routine, which I couldn't do anyway,
but,
you know, because it's visual and it was terrible.
But
I don't know where, the thing was where we just decided when a comic comes in, just make him part of the conversation.
Yeah.
And most of the time, that's what we do. And we get comics that come in, and they'll do about 2 or 3 segments of the show, maybe an hour, if they're new. And they'll go, dude, this is so different than most of the radio I do. And we'll go, well, why? And they say, what has happened? And I'll cut their disc jockey, the radio guys, a break. I've been very lucky that I haven't been under the gun of a program director all these years, because I've been able to stay on the top and not have a guy come in and go, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong, you're doing this wrong, make this quicker.
Right.
We've been very lucky. We've worked for 2 incredible companies that believe in freedom.
Right.
But these guys, I'll give you the radio guy's perspective. Let's say a guy in Des Moines who gets 1 rating book or 2 ratings books a year, and he's got a guy who's untalented, who's his program director, going, you need to do this, and have that guy in there, and why isn't he telling jokes? Why the fuck isn't that guy telling jokes?
Right.
Instead of letting the guy have
letting
a conversation.
Letting him do the weather or something.
So what happens is they come in and these disc jockeys will sit there and go, well, so Doug Benson, I hear you're a marijuana smoker.
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy, are you ever worried about law enforcement?
And
then they'll go to, turn the mic off and they'll go, so how can I lead you into some of your jokes, man? What do you want to do? Should I bring up airport food is the old standby. So I think that's the thing that Patton Oswalt hates.
Yeah.
Is that you get up early in the morning and it's Yuckle and Chuckle going, hey, Patton Oswalt.
Yeah, yeah.
They hate that because they're not allowed just to have a normal flow of conversation, and they're expected to do their bits, which on our perspective, I've always had comics in and said, hey, man, catch up when you can, jump in when you can. And since we've added Matt Bearden to the show, he's given me the perspective that there's also a thing. They don't know. These comics coming in don't know who you are and don't know what to expect. So let's take some time and tell them during the break and say, hey, man, don't worry about it if you got nothing to say. But if you got something to say, either raise your hand or just jump in when you can.
Yeah.
And be part of the story and the conversation. So that's the comedy perspective that we've had. And we've always, and we've ended up making great friends that way. I mean, we have some people who used to do the show who ended up being our buddies who
who are some of them?
Ron White was one of my, you know, moving into my house.
Yeah.
He was leaving his girl, and he'll tell you this. If you ever have him on, he'll tell you he called me and said, I'm going to send some boxes over. He broke up with his girlfriend, didn't have any money. And he called me one day. He goes, is Jeff Foxworthy just called me? He wants me to go on some redneck comedy tour. I'll call you. I'll save the room. I'll call you when I'm done. And he called me a few weeks later. He goes, man, you're not going to believe this, but I'm on Foxworthy's jet, and we're packing the house. And that was it. And now he's has a house in L.A. and a house in Atlanta, and he's doing well. But when I look back, when it's all done, that'll be some gratifying stuff, is that I made these friendships with people.
I love that guy. Dale Dudley. I wish I could see that prop comic stuff. Anyway, so then, later on, Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's, who was a big supporter of this, and we've played together. I had a band with her, and she had me in her band, and I've been a fan of the Go-Go's, and I'm friends with other members of the Go-Go's as well. And I just love Kathy, and our podcast was really good. You should go back and listen to that one. I can't remember what number it is exactly, but search through these things. Anyway, so Kathy came and we talked about the Go-Go's going on Saturday Night Live, and she was talking about kind of what a debacle it was and kind of how difficult it was at the time. So here's my friend Kathy Valentine talking about Saturday Night Live and the Go-Go's again.
And then the other thing was Saturday Night Live, which was, you know, millions and millions. I think it was like it was either 6 million or 60 million. I don't know. It was a lot of people watched us on that. And we weren't very good on it. It was kind of a disaster, but still.
Why was that? Was it just?
Well, we were just messed up. No,
did you guys start partying once?
We got there at 11 in the morning and did our little sound check. And then we kind of just stayed there, which you're supposed to do. And I think we drank something, and then went too far this way, get some of that, go that, and then too much that way. And by the time it was like six, we were there for like 6 hours before we played. And I think when it was time to walk out, we were all really high, and it was nerve wracking and not a good way to be.
Yeah. The music was just a little ahead of you probably the whole time.
Yeah, I don't think I don't watch stuff like that. I don't know. I should go see. Maybe it's not as bad as I remember it.
It's probably not.
It probably is.
So that was for the first record you were on there.
Yeah.
Who was the host? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was, God, what's wrong with me? I think it was Bernadette Peters.
Oh, wow.
And Eddie Murphy was on there.
Yeah, he was in there. Yeah. One of my favorite people, Kathy. I do. I love her. Sorry, these are getting a little shorter. Next on deck. Oh, you know what? I'm going to go see the Go-Go's. I'm going to New York here in September towards the end there. Going to New York and I'm playing a solo show. I'm playing a show with Skyrocket. Playing two shows with Skyrocket. Then when I come back, like on Monday, the Go-Go's are in Houston. And Tuesday, the Go-Go's are here. I think I'm going to go to both, man. Is that insane? It's insane. Anyway, so then I got this field recorder. I started going out and meeting people places, so this one's a little noisier. I went and met Tim Palmer, who's like a giant producer, engineer, mixer guy. And he mixed so much stuff and produced so much stuff. Robert Plant, Ozzy Osbourne, Pearl Jam, tons and tons of bands. I don't even know where to start. Anyway, he talks about mixing Pearl Jam 10 here and how they had it remixed. So we met at Jim's and had breakfast one morning, And he told me about this part of the interview. The story's great. He even worked on Guns N' Roses' Chinese Democracy. That story's great, too. But here's the Pearl Jam story. Tim Palmer.
Right, I think. It's funny, because with the when I mixed the Pearl Jam record, we were coming out of the 80s, right. Where things were sounding big, rock bands were sounding big, we used reverbs, we used delays, and it was exciting. And when the whole grunge thing happened, it was all about sounding like you're playing in a room with no frills, no special delays on the end of lines, and things like that. That wasn't what it was about. It was about being raw. And when we made the Pearl Jam record, that hadn't happened yet. Because the fact is, the first Pearl Jam record was mixed before Nirvana was successful, before the Seattle scene broke out.
Right.
So I wasn't even aware of, you know, this change.
Right.
So we made a pretty big sounding record.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't afraid to put delays on Eddie or reverbs on things and try and make this go dry here and this go wet here and, you know, sort of have fun with it.
Right.
And, you know, I think in a way, because the radio hadn't changed either, it was a nice sounding record to play on the radio.
Yeah, obviously it was.
But they, of course, once the Seattle scene established, some of the band was sort of like, oh, our record, the first record was too wet.
Slick,
But so what? That's what we did. That was the time.
Yeah.
They were there, you know. They were approved every song. They sat next to me and gave me the okay. There was never any, you know, do you think it's too wet? Otherwise, we would have discussed it and maybe done something different. But that wasn't where we were.
Right.
But the funny thing about it is that finally, after 20 years or whatever it was, like last year, they remixed their album.
They
got Brendan O'Brien to mix it, and he made a raw version of 10, which I personally didn't prefer. I could understand where it was coming from. But the funny thing is, they took so long to do it that the way people are making music now, the way it was mixed first time is so much more contemporary.
Right.
Now, the funny, when you listen to them, yesterday when I listened to the local rock station, 101X, I heard a track off 10, Jeremy, and then I thought, wow, this sounds like a lot of records nowadays, because there's the use of delays and reverbs people having fun again in the studio.
Yeah.
And that was out for so long. So, ironically, the earlier mixes now are the ones that sound contemporary.
Right.
Not the remixes. They left it too late. They should have done that, you know, at the moment or something.
Oh, yeah. I really liked that that episode. I loved hanging out with him and having breakfast. I haven't seen him since, but he was a really gracious guy, told some great stories. I suggest going back and listening to that one for sure. Fast forward, got into December. At the beginning of December is when my girlfriend Jessie left to go home to Ohio for a month for Christmas. And she left and she never came back from then. Still. Her stuff's still here. I'm not kidding you. Anyway, the week of Christmas, I had two of my best friends on. That was a good one. I did some shows with Joseph King, and I got together with Casey McPherson from Alpha Rev, and we had a great conversation, Casey and I. I suggest going back and listening to that one for sure. So in this one, he had been signed to Hollywood Records, and he had been let go a few months earlier, and he told me the story of how he got his record back from the label, which involves his fans, Steve Jobs. What? Check this out. Casey McPherson, Alpha Rev. We'll both
bleed in these thoughts. They let you go?
No, I mean, they basically stopped returning my phone calls and said, we're dropping you, you know? And so I finally get a hold of the VP over there. And
was your guy Jason gone at that point?
No, he's still there. They didn't even tell him. You know, he was on maternity leave because he was having a kid.
Okay.
So I said, well, that's cool. You can drop us, but give me, you know, I've got like 20 songs with you guys between Dwight's record and the new record. You know, just I'd like it back. And they just laughed at me. You know, they're like, you're not going to get this back. Not only are we not going to promote it, but we're not going to give you your music back.
And what a horrible, it's like the biggest Goliath you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Disney. You know, and so I sat there.
Like, how are you going to fight Disney?
It's impossible. Like, you know, my attorney just said.
Not even in a biblical way.
Yeah, my attorney just said, shut up. deal with it and move on, yeah. you know? And I bit my nails. I'm like, this is not right. This is not right. This is not right. So I came up with this plan, and I wouldn't tell my new manager at the time, or my attorney this, because I knew they would say, you know, tell me not to do it. Basically sent out an emailer with the VP of business affairs, the attorney for Hollywood Records, sent out an email or my email to all my fans and said, look, they're not giving me my music back. Will you email this guy and tell him how much this music that you want?
Know you did that.
Yeah. That you want Alpha Rev to have their music back. So,
you think it'll work with Steven if I do that? No, go ahead.
It might, because what happened was this guy all of a sudden starts getting hundreds of emails in his inbox, and he gets super pissed off, and he calls my attorney, and he's like, what the hell is Casey doing?
That is fucking awesome that you did that.
And, well, what was awesome is our fans were cool enough to really follow through, yeah. you know? And turns out one of our fans in Dallas, I actually think it is, I don't remember, and I haven't had a chance to look him in the eye and thank him, but he knew Bob Iger and Steve Jobs. And, you know, Steve Jobs being alive at the time and being a majority owner of Disney and Hollywood Records, he copied them on the email to the vice president.
You're kidding me.
No. And so
why isn't this like just should have been on the front page of the news? This is amazing.
It's well, yeah, I've actually never talked about it before on air or anything like that, you know. So basically the day after, we get an email from this guy, and he calls my attorney and says, "We're drafting up the licensing agreement today, you know. All I ask is that Casey send out a
an email saying that
I'm working with them." And so I happily did, you know, I copied every, he forwarded me every single email he got in his inbox, and I replied to every single one of our fans that emailed him and said, thank you, they're working with us. And so we got all our masters back because of that. And
so you own that record?
Yeah.
Free
I mean,
and clear?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I still pay them, you know, yeah, for, still, which great. Which they should get money if yeah, I get success with sure. that record at all, you know, they invested a lot of time and resources into it, but now it's fair.
Fair's fair, dude. Legend of Billie Jean. Fair is fair. Great story, right? Exciting story. So then the new year happened, and I had my dear friend Will Sexton on. I've been friends with him since we were teenagers, and he told a quick story. About people requesting songs from the audience into the stage. So this is actually a pretty funny story. I love Will Sexton dearly, and here he is.
You know, that was the other thing, just to tie it in on something else that I was just telling a story the other day. I was playing maybe 8-10 years ago, and someone came in and wanted to hear a Stevie Ray Vaughan song. And it's just kind of like, you know, that same kind of, you know, heckling kind of, you know, it's like yeah. they want to, whatever, bird. Just, yeah, free bird. Yeah. That's just like, just, you know, just get out of my face kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, this vision just was hung right, you know, right before me. Was like, when we used to play at the Cheatham Street Warehouse with Stevie, there was like 5 people there, and every one of them wanted to hear ZZ Top, or, you know, and so, you know, so it's like the irony of the whole thing for that moment. It's like, instead of getting pissed off, I was like going, why is this annoying? You know, it's like kind of, it's like, I should play this song for Steve, you know? So I did, I did some half cocked version of,
well, here's the question: would Stevie play a ZZ song?
No, I don't. You know, just, but it's that whole thing. And I was just talking with my brother. We were talking about that the other day, and he's like, just going, "Yeah." Or they would go like, "Why don't you let the kids play?" and then of course, you know, go forward 15 years, or however long, and it's like everyone was at that show,
right?
So yeah, going, yeah, I used to see you and Charlie yeah, play yeah. with Stevie. It was like going, really?
Yeah. Fill your mind with its
constant storming now.
Sure, one of our buddies there, Will Sexton. This is Todd V. Wolfson, correspondent for How Did I Get Here?
And good friend of the show.
Because I am. I'm a
and the show's photographer, I would say, because you provide a lot of photos on the Facebook page.
Oh, that one in Denny's. Of the people. Denny's
well, not just the Denny's one, but I'll often have a guest. Then there's guests that you suggest, and you've hooked me up with Alejandro.
And you hooked me up with...
But you know what I mean? You've got pictures that you put up there. So
this podcast, it's 100 episodes. 100 episodes. And did you ever think you'd get to 10? Did you ever think you'd make 50? What did you feel starting this out?
Well, when I started it out, I've talked about this before, that, you know, I was kind of at, I've listened to this stuff. I've always wanted to kind of do something like this. And anyway, the opportunity to be able to do it and then kind of seeing Nakia and getting an idea of that I could do this kind of show where I could talk to people about what they were going through while stuff was happening around them, you know? Like, and basically, so it keeps them in the game because I felt so disconnected, you know, from my community at the time that it's also kind of plugged me back in where I feel like I'm...
When we saw this guy on The Voice, our friend Nakia, because we're closer to him, we know him, we love him, that's what really made your brain go,
I didn't really know him. But I knew him well enough to where I could get a hold of him and interview him. You know what I mean? And that's what I thought. I was like, well, you know, you're watching something and you think to yourself like, wow, you know, that guy was playing at Saxon Pub last week. This week, he's in like 25 million homes. And what is that
it's
like?
Gotta
he's
be
singing,
weird.
He's singing CeeLo's song to CeeLo. CeeLo turns around. I mean, all that stuff is like, that's something you'd love to sit there and talk to somebody about something like that. And I that's what gave me the idea of the show. That I could do kind of how did I get here?
Was it nerve-wracking? Was it like...
It still is very nerve-wracking. Like even, you know...
Like what things happened, like, don't tell me so much now, but in the beginning when you were trying to put it together and figure it out technically and socially, you know, how you're going to make everybody, you know...
The first one, about it. I did one before I did... The first one that I put out, I did one with Jeremy Nail, and that turned out terribly because of me. I talked over him, and it was just kind of weird. And so I went back and reassessed, and then I did the Susanna one, and then I realized that it took me like a week to actually put it out because, you know, I realized once I put it out, then I had to keep putting them out, or I was the guy that put out the two episodes of the podcast. Exactly. Like so many, you know, so many people do that. So many podcasts start. Very few go into the hundreds.
I think a lot of our friends over the years, people we know that are artists, some of them give up. And, you know, I don't look at you as that kind of person. You're motivated. You're passionate. You love people, you know?
And it's fun. I mean, it's a lot of work, but I get a lot out of doing it personally. Like, I get a lot out of sitting down and just kind of consorting with my peers.
But,
you know?
Consorting with the peers, you know, you have a similar story to some of them not at all. But, like, where is the vibe for you? What is it that you're getting from
their
it,
story.
Besides the information part of it? Like, what is
just
it?
Just kind of how to deal with things as they come, you know, how do different people deal with things? There was one with Sounds Under Radio where they were kind of, I think it was even the second one, where the craziest shit happened to their band, but they somehow banded together and got through it. And I've not had that experience, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was exciting to hear. And it's inspiring. It makes you want to keep on going, you know?
Has there been something, because you've had your successes, you've had your, you know, harder times. Was there anybody on there that you...
You won't drop an F-bomb.
No, I don't want to drop any F-bombs. But
first was your marriage.
But I mean,
then there was the dissolution of Panjandrum.
But you've had the Donnie Wins, you've had the Alejandros, the producers, the artists that have done more than your average
and
bear.
And then maybe somebody who just is putting out their first or second record or something.
But here was my question, whether it's the guy like Alejandro, Donnie, people who've experienced some different levels of success, or the basic, you know, some of the youngest band people you've talked to, was there anybody that just gave you some click of, wow, this is really useful to me?
You know, I will say that in almost every one, there's at least one, you know, one moment of that, you know?
Yeah. Because that's what...
I mean, there've been, the reason I'm not going to lie to you. There have been a couple where I've just been like, oy vey, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, Jesus, yeah. Shut up.
Like this. But but what I'm saying is like, I agree with what you're saying. I guess I'm asking the question for them is like, I know when I listen to him, it's the reason I'm asking you.
Right.
That's what I get from him is that I've learned things from T-Double. I've learned things from Cat. I've found interesting historical notes about other people that I didn't know. And you, in the midst of all doing all the interviews, I've known you for years, and I know that with each episode, I'm probably finding out a little bit more about you each time, you know, another layer of the onions.
Yeah.
Being taken away, and I think it's really awesome.
Thanks. You know what? I'm as big or small or experienced or not experienced. Really, what I'm going for is sort of their experience, and if as long as people just come in here, and I think that's what makes it work differently than a professional interviewer. You know what I mean? Where I'm just kind of a dude that does what you do, and so
yeah, and it's
like you're not gonna jive me probably. I feel like I have been, I feel, I'm not gonna say, but I feel like there have been a couple of people in here that came in here with their agenda and what they wanted to get across.
For the most part, I've listened to all of them, and it's very human. It's very,
that's what I like, that's what I
want. It's human interest, you know, it's what we love that stuff.
We it's kind of a nerd thing, you know what I mean? I mean I want to hear two people talk about stuff, so we've been talking for a long time. But okay. I love doing it, and it's really helped me out, and I feel like it's made me a lot happier. Do you notice I'm happier?
Yes, you're very happier, and whatever he tells me to say, I'll say it. But this is a happy guy. He's doing something that I love. I'm passionate about it. I mean, I'm his friend.
Yeah.
But I'm not just going to say this. I truly, you know, spend my time listening to these. One of the last ones he just did with Casey Crowley. They're two people I love. So
I will say this. I like those ones like John Leffler and Jeff Plankenhorn and Casey Crowley's and Billy Harvey's standout. And Susanna's, the first one, as ones where there's just a whole lot of laughter in them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like those a lot. I don't know if I just like them because those people all know how to make me laugh.
Well, sadly, you and I are a lot funnier than we are right now. But I wanted to pay you some props and...
Well, thank you.
Congratulate you on this 100th episode. And I know I can't wait to hear what the next 5, 10, 15, 20 are, you know?
Yeah. Well, they're going to get crazy.
Thank you, Johnny Gavin.
Thank you. Thank you, Todd. Hey, so the next bit that we're going to go into comes from one that you actually helped me set up.
With?
Alejandro Escovedo.
Oh, that's my... I'm wearing his T-shirt.
And you're wearing his T-shirt. And in this one, he's going to talk about how he took on an infamous tour where he played 7 shows in 7 weeks.
Wow. That guy's got stories.
Yeah, he's got stories. So this is kind of an early story, kind of a good rock and roll story. And I love their inventory when they leave the tour. So here's a little Alejandro Escovedo. Thank you, Todd Wolfson. Just before the cops arrived and took off with the noise.
It was nothing special, just another bar. And that's when we took that infamous 7 gigs in 7 week tour.
What was that?
We went on tour. Rank and File went on tour. We had 7 gigs in 7 weeks.
How did you manage?
And we went from New York City all the way up to Vancouver, BC. You know, and so we would like end up, you know, like our first gig was in Dayton, Ohio. You know, and then I think we went to Cincinnati. And then maybe shot down to Houston or something like that. But we'd end up staying like a week.
In every town.
Like crashing in people's... We were like the guests that would not leave, you know. So,
How did that... Did you guys have fun doing that?
It was a great experience. Yeah, it was a great experience. We left on the night that Reagan was elected president.
Okay.
And we had $50, a roasted chicken, and a bag of pot. And that was it.
That's all you needed, really.
Yeah. And it was just about getting from... town to town.
Right. Well, then how did you guys end up in Austin? You guys went back
That was part of that tour. And Lester Bangs was here,
uh-huh.
And we knew Lester from New York, you know, and he was staying with the Contempo Culture people.
So he was living here at one point?
Yeah, he was staying here. And he was working with that band, the Delinquents, I think they were called.
I don't know.
They were part of the Raoul's
Clubfoot
days, you know. And so we got to meet all those people, hung out with them. Lester was here.
Yeah.
And
had you had any roots here? I mean, you were from San Antonio, but you grew up.
I used to come here when I was a kid.
You did?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, with my mother. She'd come here to buy records and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, let me think. So Austin just seemed, you know, we played Raul's.
Yeah.
It was, the last final days of Raul's, probably. But we played there on the drag and just fell in love with the town.
The town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd always wanted to come back to Texas. I was born in San Antonio.
Right. I was also reading that you come from such an eclectic musical background, like growing up, as far as like your listening and your kind of musical upbringing,
uh-huh.
that you appreciated Austin for its at that time, and I guess it's still to this day it has it.
Well, it's very, you know,
eclectic.
Not only eclectic, but the community is so accepting of so many different styles and types of music and combinations of, like, when we first moved here. You know, we'd do shows with Bill Neely, who had played with Jimmy Rogers, right?
Right.
Or learned from Jimmy Rogers and Kenneth Threadgill and those guys. Yeah, the Big Boys.
Right.
So Leroy Brothers, Rank and File, and the Dicks. You know, that would be like a bill.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing.
Yeah.
It was really cool. We'd play gigs with Lucinda a lot when we were first starting at the Transact and the Shorthorn.
She was here then, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
She was busking on the drag, you know? Good. Yeah. Honest truth, it's a terrible
thing. Alejandro, that was an amazing interview. I went to his place, which was a little different, and I used my field recorder, but that one actually sounds pretty good. I thought that one sounded good. Anyway, so then South by Southwest came along, and I tried to get some sounds of the street, but I put out these shows, which I guess are going to be now traditional kind of South by Southwest shows, where I have short interviews with a lot of people, and then put out like a show with like four different people. I interviewed an astronaut. I interviewed a Brazilian guy. and while I was out roaming the streets doing a man on the street experiencing South by Southwest for you guys, I saw a guy walking around in a cape and a thong and cowboy boots, and they're kind of like these last ditch effort guys. So I'm going to play you that part of my South by Southwest show. I'm meeting GOAT, which stands for God of All Texas. Here's a little South by Southwest episode. Okay, so I just saw you walking down the street. What's your name?
My name's GOAT.
GOAT.
It's an acronym for the God of All Texas.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Well, you're wearing a Texas cape. You're wearing underwear.
Texas
you're just
flag.
In your underwear. Texas flag underwear. Yeah. It's holding your Johnson in there, and you've got a bass.
Yep.
And so what you're wearing a cowboy hat. What are you doing? What is your thing?
I'm making money on the street, playing music.
That's smart.
Mostly taking pictures.
Yeah.
It's a good way to make money.
Yeah.
I've done a lot
Let's
better doing this
up,
than
pictures.
Actually gigging.
Yeah.
But I love gigging, and this is just basically self-promotion, you know?
Yeah.
And at the same time, I'm
making a
band?
Too.
Yeah.
Called
GOAT? I'm literally playing right down the street here.
Are you going to be
minutes.
In this getup when
yes,
you're playing?
Yes, I'm going to be
Excellent.
In this getup. The band is called The Goat and Your Mom. That's the God of All Texas and your Masters of Menace.
Okay. Now I think I'm definitely going to come. Hey, that's my card for my podcast. You'll be able to hear it. It'll be up next week. But
right on.
Thanks, Goat. Thanks for taking a minute to talk to me.
Yeah, literally 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock.
I'm headed there right now.
All right. So basically, it's like a dude in his underwear or like in a thong with the Texas flag thong and his. Honey. That, you know, by that point during South by Southwest, I'll be honest, I was really like, I was over it. I was like, all that it seemed to me was like sad, and all I could see was people that were like doing anything, like walking around in a thong and a cape, a guy with a wolf head mask and wolf feet and wolf hands playing violin on a corner, people climbing things, people smashing things because it's their big chance. They're playing on the corner. They're screaming their song out. Somebody, understand me, recognize me, validate me. So I started going nuts, and so I had that kind of insane tone by that point. Anyway, so after South by Southwest, I did an interview with Kurt Newman from the Bodines, who's a big idol of mine, and I've since gotten to hang out with his family I went and hung out with his family at a show, and it was fantastic. They invited me. And he has the most beautiful and like loving family of any family. And so I've been trying since to somehow ingratiate myself to them more, to a point where maybe I'll be their really creepy older brother. I mean, not that I'm creepy, but it's just creepy that, why is that guy like in his 40s? Because he's old. He was an adopted late adoption. A mistake, an adoption mistake. Anyway, here's Kurt Newman.
Well, I was born in Milwaukee, which is a big city, you know, so for the first 8 years of my life, I really had exposure to a lot of living in a big city and crime and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was reading that.
And then when I was 8, we moved out to the country, which was like moving to Mars. It was the strangest thing in the world for me.
But the impetus was, there was a murder of a girl that lived next door to you. And what, was she young? Was she a friend of yours? And
no, didn't know anything about the person, and no one ever talked about it to me to explain who it was or anything about it. It turns out it was a 9-year-old girl named Donna Willing, and yeah, we just came home from dinner one night into our back alley, and it was just lined full of police cars, and they had found this girl's body. And all my life, I'd been walking around telling people this story. Like, you wouldn't believe what happened when I was a kid. They found this girl's, because it kind of described the neighborhood I was in. I had seen lots of hit-and-run accidents as a kid. I'd seen people getting stabbed, and my dad worked as a manager of a JCPenney store way down on 35th and North in Milwaukee, which was a lot of crime and stuff. And I would go down there to his store after school sometimes and work with him and stuff in the basement. And so all this was just to kind of represent this area I came from, and what a culture shock it was to go from that out to the woods and the country and wide open cornfields and stuff like that. And so
what was that like? Were you happy? Because I mean, you were 8, so it's like you could run around.
Oh, I was really happy.
Be free. And
I tell people the other story. The first day I was really there in the woods, I was just sitting there listening to the wind blow through the trees, one of my favorite sounds in the world. And it was so peaceful, there wasn't a noise. All of a sudden I hear these leaves crinkling like behind me, and I turn around and look about 10 feet behind me, and there's a horse standing there, you know, just in the woods. A horse is standing there looking at me. And I'd never seen anything like that. I'd never been around anything like that.
Right.
You know, you see pigeons in the city, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And it just blew my mind. It was literally like being on a different planet.
I was like, I like that story, because you kind of, you know, you get informed by stuff as a kid, and that's, I like to go there with people and find that stuff out too. Here, how did I get here? So that's a little bit from Kurt Newman's childhood from the Bodines. Another thing that we touch on a lot here is the, you know, when you have friends that are musicians, a lot of us tend to hang out together, and a lot of times, you know, you think the other guy's really got it made, you know, and the other guy thinks you've got it made. And so, my good friend Billy Harvey was here, working on the Courtyard Hounds album with members of the Dixie Chicks, and he stopped by to do this interview. Billy's fantastic. Anyway, so we had this conversation about that, how we were both together in L.A. at one point. I was mixing a record, and he was there doing this big writing thing, and here's the story about that. Here's my friend Billy Harvey. How did you like those? I mean, that's kind of an odd thing.
Yeah, I do remember that. Was there an earthquake?
There was an earthquake the night before I left to New York.
Oh,
Yeah, but we went to go see Tina Yothers that night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we went to go see her play.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Because she was mixing where I was, and you and I went to go see. We like, met her grandparents and shit.
Holy cow.
How weird is that?
Holy shit.
So, so what was that like when you went out there and wrote? Did you... were you writing for you at that point? Like, you had done that record, and you were trying to sort of develop the Billy Harvey brand, right?
Yeah.
And so, did people suggest that you go write with other people? And...
I ended up getting a development deal with MCA, and they, you know, they wanted me to co-write because they wanted a hit. And so they set me up. again, you know,
these are all so weird. Because
again, I look at it and I'm like, it happened how it was supposed to happen, you know, because it was a disaster of
was
a writing trip. Yeah, like half the dudes canceled on me. Like Mark Hudson, did you?
Yeah, I know who he is. I never wrote with him.
I have nothing bad to say about him. I don't know him, but you know, I was supposed to write with him, and something came up for him, so he canceled. A few other things canceled. There were some bizarre pairings. Like they put me with lyricists, which is ridiculous.
It's kind of a weird thing, yeah.
Like not, you know, not that I'm so and so, but I, you know, that it's something I got kind of a I have kind of a handle on, you know.
Right.
I met a few people that you know, there was some good some good pairings too, and but it, you know, it wasn't my time. I definitely wasn't ready. You know, we ended up cutting a few songs. I got to pick my dream team, and I worked with, you know, like I got to work with John Bryan and this guy Tom Rothrock, and I had Elvis Costello's band, and
I remember that.
And yeah. I was horrible. Like when I listened to this, I'm like, I am the worst guy in the bunch. I was not ready. So
how?
And it didn't happen.
How
and
is that?
It because it's,
I mean, you were you aware of that then? Or did
I was
you
not.
Think
I wasn't aware of that then. I was aware of how frustrating it was that I couldn't get what I thought I could do in my head out into the real world. What I realize now in hindsight is, you know, it's all this emotional work. It's just, I'm a late bloomer. Like, it takes me a long time. I almost, you know, it just takes me a long time to get. Some people have it when, you know, when they're 19. I think maybe I'm starting to get it now, but 10 years from now, I'll look back and go, wow, I didn't even have it then, you know? But right. I feel more in control of actually being able to actualize my thoughts and my, you know, my desires, you know. And at the time, you know, I remember doing vocals on these songs, and you know, we have top notch, you know, everything. We're in,
yeah.
I remember Brian Wilson poked his head in while we were recording, you know. I'm like, wow, you know,
yeah, I'm here,
and I'm singing on the mic, and I feel nothing, and my voice sounds like I feel nothing, and you know, so I'm drinking whiskey thinking that'll help. That doesn't help. And you know, I'm like, there's nothing I could do. Like, you know, somebody would have had to literally, and that maybe they should have, you know, they you know, slap me around or like really like awaken me, because I was just dead, you know. I just I listen to those songs now, and it's just bizarre how much money you can throw at something and have
still
it suck.
Not work. Yeah.
It's a good thing to know. Yeah. I think all experience is valuable if you have a desire to evolve.
Sure.
And so, you know, I'm thankful that I had that one, because now I have some great insight that I didn't have before, you know, because of that.
Yeah.
Know? But a month at the Roosevelt I was broke as hell, and I'm in LA. It's expensive. I don't know anyone. I'm there a month. I was lonely. It was
me too.
It was not a good time. And I love the Roosevelt.
Yeah, when I went there without the band, I just would like walk around by myself.
Yeah.
Go to the movies by myself. Go sit at the Seventh Veil by myself. on like a Monday night and be like the only guy there.
Yeah.
And then talk to the door guy for an hour when I was leaving. Just to talk to someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that feeling. I'm glad. You know, it's so funny because when you're in the moment, I was there, I'm making this record, and, you know, in my mind, there you were, you know, you're coming on this writing trip, this is going to be awesome, and...
Right.
And so you always think the other guy's like, man, that guy's just, he's got it made.
Yeah.
But you're just like, oh, what the fuck? What am I doing here? This is so awkward. I'm all alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wild. And I think Facebook does a lot to misrepresent people nowadays, you know, because you take a picture, you go somewhere, you post a picture from 5 years ago, you do, you know,
yeah.
And like my Facebook page looks like I got the shit going on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I, in some ways,
you're always like in some Indonesian country.
Yeah,
and like,
in some ways I do, but you see the trip picture that happened, but you don't see the other 11 months where I'm in the tub depressed with my cell phone. Like, I'm not streaming that video.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, we want to go where we want to go. Put this side up to you or me. I'm not streaming that video. That Billy Harvey, man, he's a funny guy. I love that guy. So, man, so we're rounding out the interviews here. We're sliding out the end of the show here. I talked to David Grissom, guitar player, from Austin, Storyville. That was his own band, but he played with Joe Ely, played with John Cougar Mellencamp a lot, played with the Dixie Chicks a lot, and he's put out his own records. He's got a lot of endorsements. He's like a guitar hero, legitimate, like, hero of guitar. Great guy. I love him. I've known him for a real long time. And here's a little story from David Grissom. A little soul story. Fine as a funky little thing can be, low down. Lean low, rider cruising down the street. So what was your first gig? You got in with Lou Ann Barton? Was that
first gig was Lucinda Williams.
Oh yeah?
You might have heard of her. She was just a little singer songwriter. You know, I moved down here. I didn't know protocol from Adam, and called the writer at the Statesman at the time, Ed Ward, who's a pretty caustic dude. And I'm like, you know, looking back on it, I'm like, know him, I'm like, what was that? You know, I would have never done that in a million years, but I just moved down here and I'm like, I need a gig. I want to play.
Yeah.
And I called, and somebody had said that, yeah, you should call this guy that writes for the Statesman. And I called him up and he says, like, I'm not a matchmaker. I don't know if you're any good, but if you are, I know this lady that's looking for a guitar player. Her name's Lucinda Williams. And, you know, here's her number if you want to call her. And I called her and got the gig. And she was just living in a little bitty one-bedroom apartment over there behind the Continental Club. The apartments Willie used to own.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Are long gone. And within a month, I'm on my way to the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. And we stopped in Lake Charles on the way to Crawfish Farm. They knew it was with Ed Ward and Lucinda and the band.
So he actually did get you a gig.
Even though the protocol was weird and he wasn't a matchmaker. Yeah, I was definitely not, I would definitely, as I said, after getting to know him and everything, I would never dream of doing anything like that. But
it still worked.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, Derek O'Brien had gotten into her band too. So we had two guitar players. And then Derek became one of my best friends. And he basically just got me into Lou Ann's band. And Lou Ann really dug what I did. And so all of a sudden, by virtue of the fact that I play with Lou Ann, I can go to Antone's for free.
Right.
And I'm in sort of that world. And I can't even stress how instrumental that was in really making me grow as a player, being able to just walk in and not pay a cover and sort of be in that family of people. That was just, you know, again, a magical time. And, you know, God, Clifford was bringing in Otis Rush and Buddy Guy and Albert King and Albert Collins and Jimmy Rogers and all these guys constantly. And that was when, you know, I could come from my apartment on South First Street and decide I want to go out at midnight and cruise up Guadalupe.
Right.
And there wasn't a car on the road. But then you pull into the parking lot at Anton's and you start to hear the music. And you walk in and it's wall-to-wall and the joint is just totally rocking. And I went out every night.
I love that story because it's such an innocent and endearing story of blind ambition. And how it can actually is really irritating when you're young like that and you don't really know what you're doing. You're just literally just going for it. You don't give a fuck. You just want it. I love that guy, too. What a nice guy. Anyway, well, that's it, man. That's episode 100. All right? Ah, wow. So this is it. We're going into the next 100. Hopefully, I'll be able to bring you better stories, even better stories. Maybe get some deeper stories, get some fucking stuff going on with some folks in here. Thank you so much for being so supportive. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to all of you. I got a call from this guy, Dave McNair. He's a mastering guy, producer, mixer, engineer, lives up in New York. He called me the other day on Saturday to tell me how grateful he was that I was doing this. And I appreciate that so much because I love doing it. And I think I get, hopefully, you're getting as much out of it as I am. So thank you. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the next 100, you know. I'm going to do some, I've got some stuff lined up. Got some stuff coming up. Bob Schneider. This should be a good one. It's actually the next one, 101. So we got that to look forward to. And, you know, I promised to play How Did I Get Here by Fastball at the end of this thing, but I put it in episode 99. But I also put this song in episode 99. I just want to pay homage because I want to thank Corey Glazer and Sheboygan for the great song. And I'm looking forward to having them on sometime in the next 100 when their record comes out. I'm looking forward to doing more live ones. And thank you. Subscribe on iTunes. Follow me on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. I thank you for listening to the 100 episodes. Did you, you know, go back if you haven't heard them all. Go back, search through, see what's going on. All right? Do it. This is Sheboygan, Needle Hits the Groove. It's our theme song, but it's in its entirety. Thank you for listening. Let's get down. Feeling